Hello, everyone. It is August 15, 2018, and I'm talking today with Dave Dennis, who will be talking about his experiences with SIAP and the growing of the National Alliance. So, hi, Dave.
Fine, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Okay, so the first question I have prepared is, you worked with SNCC and CORE during the Civil Rights Movement, and how did these experiences influence your work with SIAP?
Well, I guess to talk a little bit about how I got involved with the Algebra Project, because SIAP is actually grew out of the Algebra Project.
Right.
It's once a program of the Algebra Project. And so when I began working with the Algebra Project in 1992 with Bob, it was the idea there was to begin to work with the Algebra Project to the Deep South. At the time I came on, the Algebra Project, as far as South has come, was in Atlanta, in Atlanta, Georgia, with the school system there. And so the Algebra Project received a grant from the Southern Regional Council by way of the Ford Foundation to experiment with the project in the Deep South. And so Bob wanted to bring it to Mississippi, so it was based on my experience with him in organizing during the 60s. The reason why he brought in, because what we wanted to do was to begin to develop a community organized base and the methods we used in the Civil Rights Movement to put the project together in Mississippi, because we felt that there you would have to put a floor beneath them you tried to do in the schools, because there we knew we were working with the bottom quartile, at the lowest level. And so it was that experience that really got me involved. I think it's why Bob brought me in as part of the Algebra Project, rather organized at what we called then the site development portion of the Algebra Project. So it was through those experiences that we had, is about knowledge not only in terms of Mississippi and the Delta, but also in terms of how to do grassroots organizing, which I learned from my experience with CORE beginning in Louisiana in 1960.
Yeah, that makes sense. So SIAP grew out of the Algebra Project, as you mentioned. Can you talk about the distinctions between the missions of the Algebra Project and SIAP?
Yeah, well, there's not much of a difference there. The mission has always been, when I first began the Algebra Project, was how to have access to students, the bottom quartile, and students of color, to our quality education. And so there were two issues there. One is, how do you address the issue of development of quality education in an area or place or country that did not provide that quality education for all kids? And then what education was there, how do you begin to make it accessible to students of color and students at the bottom quartile? And so based on our work in Mississippi with the Freedom Schools and others, those are some of the methods we use. So what happened here is that the Southern Initiative, which was a program, and at that time as I began working with the Algebra Project, I really wanted to work in the South. That's always been my preference in terms of when I was in the Civil Rights Movement, I remained in the South, and conditional work with the Algebra Project, and I would work with the project in the South. And so the program of the Algebra Project from 1992 on through the 90s, there's a program, the project had really moved in terms of the South into around 9 states. We actually developed sites in Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama. We had sites in South Carolina, North Carolina, some of the other areas in Georgia, and also a little bit of pieces in Tennessee.
Okay.
And so the project really did expand to a lot of different areas and sites, with the most prevalent sites being in South Carolina, and then North Carolina and Weldon, North Carolina is, and then deep part of the South Carolina, throughout the Mississippi Delta, and in Jackson, Mississippi, and in New Orleans and Louisiana were the primary sites we developed in the South. So the idea there is that the during this same period of time, that was the development of a youth component of the Algebra Project called Young People's Project. And so as we moved and the project began to get larger, Bob always felt that we should, sort of diversify. And that meant is that the youth, as they got stronger, they should have their own 501c. And so when the SIAP, the Southern Initiative, became stronger, Zary, it acquired its own 501c also. So that's sort of how it evolved is. The difference is then, of course, the YPP has a youth focus. SIAP's focus has always been old schools. And when we first began, even in 1992, we worked, the Algebra Project started out really in the South as a middle school initiative. And we soon discovered that felt that you could not just work the middle schools, because by the time kids got into middle school, they were so far behind. So you had to move the project down and you had to move it up to follow them through the high school level. Well, that experiment started a piece with Bob and then moving the project from at Brinkley Middle School on into a near high school, and then with the cohort model. And so SIAP began to really develop what we call home schools, beginning looking at elementary all the way through 12th grade. And we got our first shot at that experiment with was in St. Helena, which is in Beaufort County, South Carolina, which is a little elementary school.
Hi.
Yeah, I just realized I lost you.
That's all good. You were talking about, Beaufort County, I believe.
Yeah, okay, Beaufort County, where we got our first shot at an elementary school level.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's a whole story in itself. This is written up in Radical Equations, but
right
there we began there. There's one of the schools that was at the bottom in the state in terms of scores. And we, in a three-year period, experimented with that school. We were able to move it to one of the top schools. In fact, it beat out the Hilton Head students there, as it had a 99% black population.
Wow.
At the Hilton Head pieces. So then we began to put it together, and that moved us into Petersburg, Virginia, where we actually, for the first time, really got full funding through the Cameron Foundation, which is a local hospital foundation, a hospital like had gone under, and so they had to use the funds for local area piece there. So they funded us to work in the school system areas for 5 years. And so we were able to really put a whole package together of a pre-K through 16 by hooking in with the Virginia State University, which is a local HBCU, Presidential Black College University. So that sort of really helped to give birth to the pre-K 16 model that we now are moving around the country with a lot of emphasis on the HBCUs and the bottom quartile, looking at low performance schools. So we actually, that's practically all of the schools we work in are low performance schools in the South. So that moved us into that model. And when that model was a great model, is that we have the when we got there in 2006 was they only had one school that had been that was accredited then, and the high school had not been accredited since 1998. And so by 2010 we had all the schools but one school accredited, and that school only missed accreditation by like 5 or 6 points. And that gave us, and then we were able to move students to be able to graduate from calculus at the end of the fifth year. We had more students graduate with calculus on that belt than they had in Algebra 2 when we got there. So that was gave us this idea of how to move this, is because now you had Virginia State University now getting students locally who were able to go in who were STEM ready, run right into it, didn't have to take in prep cases, courses rather, to remedial courses in mathematics. And so that gave birth to the pre-K 16 model that we have. And so what we do now is actually working in schools, looking at feeder patterns with the with HBCUs at the top is we're now working at 5 different sites trying to develop this this model for the replication around the country.
Well, great.
So I don't know if that's, yeah. that's called the difference. So that model includes the four components of it. One is of course, professional development component, and that has to do with a summer training of teachers of a minimum of 2 weeks, and that's teachers in the entire feeder pattern, teach mathematics. And then that's going to our program is the training is followed by classroom visitations and Saturday workshops throughout the year, and with a minimum of at least 4 per year. And that is that every teacher in the program are visited by our staff at least 4 times, and that there are at least a minimum of 4 Saturday workshops throughout the year. And then that program is to go on for a minimum of 3 to 5 years, we prefer 5, but we let the minimum is 3 years, and we don't want to, that's part of one of our conditions for coming in, because we don't feel that we can make any significant changes in the way teachers teach in the less time than that, and significant changes. And so the other component to that is a youth development component, whereby we actually train students at the college level to be mentors and tutors to students in the high schools and middle schools, and students in the middle school and high schools to be tutors and mentors to students in the middle schools. Now, one of the things about this also at the university level is we're also looking at how to train students to work with federal supported programs that are developed in order to support students who are low-income students. So that's like your Upward Bound programs or your TRIO programs and things. So there could be some kind of consistency work we're doing with the students across the board, is because a lot of those students in those TRIO programs actually come out of the schools that we'd be working with in the pre-K-16 model. So it's sort of the, and you get some federal support, and that is by working with those students. And it's like building your own little army of students to give that support. The third component to that, of course, is the training and work with the faculty at the university level, especially where they have School of Education. Also with the math department is to give support for us and helping us to support the just teachers in the schools that we're working with, but also trying to figure out how to change the culture around the development of teachers. And the fourth component of that is, which we consider to be our main component, is that to begin the program is we ask for a year's planning. During that year's planning for the program is that we actually put together what we call a design team. And that design team is composed of representatives from the university level, from the school system, but also from the community, not only just parents, students, but also from businesses and also from organizations that provide services to low-performing areas, low-income areas, is actually where the kids are coming from in the bottom quartile. And so that way we get people all sort of, maybe not on the same page, but on the same book, is to see how we can all work together to give support to the students and to the work that we're trying to do in the areas. So it's really trying to change the whole culture. And the other piece is how do you really develop communities? Because redevelop communities, what's happening with the kids coming from the bottom quartile, we figured out, is that most of them, they aren't real communities. I mean, except for the fact is that groups of people live together. They have food deserts, they don't have any recreational facilities. They lack all the resources needed to have a very healthy community that exists. So we're looking at trying to how you figure out. We know we don't have the tools to create new communities, because we call it community learners, whereby there's a lot of focus on the education of the students coming from what we call these places. And a good example of that is that when we're in Petersburg, some of the students who really became lead students were the students coming out of what we call the homeless community. And mm-hmm. so some of those kids in Petersburg, they have these like old Motel 6s that have been vacated, where a lot of the homeless people live. So some of those kids who came out with excelling in mathematics actually came out of those homeless kids. And in Petersburg, we've figured out there are over 300 students who actually could be determined homeless kids in terms of what their profile is about. So we figured that we had the program have to address this issue because that's a large number of population that we find in the schools. And this whole connection, we would deal with also with the problems of HBCUs. HBCUs were actually getting more of these kids who were able to make it through high school, but they got a low performance. So there's a high level number of these kids who have to take remedial courses where we have it. So develop this pipeline of grow your own and help. It seemed to be was supportive of the HBCUs also to help them to function. So the design team became what we think is very important here is because we don't think you're going to be able to move this needle unless you get really full community support around the efforts that exist, that, you know, that we that's needed in order to move these kids. So those are the four components that we operate with this as part of the pre-K-16 model we're trying to develop at this time. And we have a lot of problems with it.
Sure.
And those problems happens to have to do with the top. And that is, that's a moving needle for us. The, as soon as you get things going, we say it takes at least about 5 years to make significant changes. That's more than the lifespan of superintendents and teachers in the area. So the result of that is we keep getting, as you get begin to get some foothold, there's a change in administration. And every time they come in, you know, they come, the new administration come in, new superintendent, they always come with their own program and things get changed. So the only way to, we think, to balance this is that you get strong community support. We really have buy-in to the program that you're trying to put together is that they have taken ownership of it. So if they change the top, you know, the top would have to be more responsive to the demands of the community, you know, and so that's why we feel that, you know, if we don't begin to put a lot more focus around developing this community support for what we're doing is, you know, we're just going to be burning rubber trying to get this thing settled into a program that's consistent. So that's more or less of what the generally what the program, what the SIAP is all about, what we do.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that very thoughtful, drawn-out answer. It's, so what have you found most rewarding in working with SIAP?
Well, I think that the is watching this change in students. I mean, one of the things that's really, it reminds me a lot of when we were working 60s in Mississippi and Louisiana was that, you know, the country really was saying that people, black people, people of color did not want to register to vote.
Right.
And so one way we had to prove that is get large numbers out there. So the demand had to come from them. So they had to show up at the polls. And so as people get to move, you know, that was really, really rewarding to say that the demand side was beginning to make the necessary demands. What's here is that watching students begin to make that changes and begin to make the demand about, you know, we want to learn, we want to be educated, and also able to show to the country, you know, that they can do this work if they just have an opportunity to do it. So that's what Petersburg, St. Helena, Weldon, and many others, well, Tallahatchie, all of the places that we worked in where we had a lot of success with this is, that's always important. Now to see a lot of these kids around who pull in different professions, they're lawyers, they're doctors, they're engineers, and stuff around the country, they stay in contact with us. And I guess that, well, for instance, when I began to work with Bob in 1992, I told him I'd give him 3 years of my life in this work. Okay, I'm still here. So it's important to me. And it is the next level in terms of what I think is the civil rights movement pieces. And if we're going to change this country, you know, the voices of these people have to be heard and they have to be brought to the table. So that's what the right. design team is saying to the countries. You know, so the impact of the design team is such whereby it's one thing to get people to the table. That's not the most difficult part, to get them to the table. They'll come to a meeting and sit at the table. The issue is how do you get their voices at the table, whereby people are willing to listen to them and they have enough information is to be able to understand what the issues really are. So part of the design team work is educating the community on the issues that's impacting their kids and their communities or place where they live. And so that's the other piece to this is that I think is extremely important.
Yeah. What has been your greatest challenge in working with SIAP and how did you deal with that challenge?
Well, the greatest challenge has been, you know, the leadership. It's not getting to the people at the bottom quartile is as I've just explained, is when you get them to the table, is, you know, how do we get them to be heard? And the problem we have here is that what I talked about earlier, this changing needle, this administration pieces. So as soon as you begin to get some foothold there is, I mean, that changes on. And so we haven't figured out yet how to stabilize that. We don't think you can be able to stabilize it from the top. We're going to have to do it from the bottom. So organizing people at the bottom, what makes that very difficult is it takes a lot of time to do this. And there is no funding in this country to do that kind of work. I mean, at least it's been made available to us. We get funded for doing professional development work. You know, we get funding for that about to do some work with students. When it gets down to really organizing at the bottom quartile to organize these communities around education, which is just like organized around the civil rights movement, what we have, that's where we do not have the funding to get that kind of a foothold. And I think that's intentional. And even when you do get it, it's for 2 or 3 years. And so that's not enough time to do the kind of organizing necessary in these communities or places where these people live.
Yeah.
So the other challenge we have is stability in terms of teachers' consistency, in that no one really wants to work in the bottom quartile in low performing schools. So most of the teachers you get coming into that level are teachers who don't want to be there. And so what they do is that's the last place that they hire. That's why in low performing schools you usually. Their teachers are last hired because they're actually trying to get jobs in other places, and when they can't find jobs other places, they end up at the bottom quartile. And then you got the Teach for America kids, students who are members who fill in those gaps. So having that kind of stability is another very difficult thing. It's going to be because if you go through the training you do and you work with them is. As soon as they can, they want to get out because the leadership that they have is so temporary, and so they can't get a foothold. So finally, sometimes you're lucky enough to get some teachers want to stick it out, but then once they get, you know, really comfortable with that work is, a new administration comes in, you know, and so that changing needle at the top is really the issue that's causing us more problems than anything else is. The fact is that the even money by itself is not going to change that unless you're able to put money into paying teachers more so that they have, you know, more of an incentive to want to stay. But to do the kind of work it takes in that bottom quartile, teachers have to put in 12, 14 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, just to stay on top of the game, you know, and they don't get paid enough money to do that. You know?
Right. So I have one last question prepared, which is, how do you see the National Alliance and its member organizations challenging educational inequity and living up to the promise of we the people?
I think that the Alliance to me is the most effective thing is to be able to focus on the national level on policy. There is some work that has to be done that we can do at the bottom quartile pieces that has to be done, but we need a strong force at the top that's going to change this, this administrative issue that I've just talked about and described. And that's all the way up to the top. The congressmen and others have to pass the kind of legislation that sort of gives the kind of support that's necessary to education. What's happening, cutting back on something, is because that's moving toward privatization of education. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that they have to do is to stop that. And one thing that the Alliance needs to do is to begin to focus on how they can begin to put the type of pressure necessary on their local congressmen, and both on terms of, and also at the state level and the national level, to make the necessary changes. So to me, it's a political question more, you know, a lot of it. So the rest of us can do a lot of the groundwork, you know, but we can't, we can only go so far until somebody begins to knock that door down. I mean, and make those changes at the top level. Is, and that's a political issue where you have to begin to threaten and put pressure on elected officials to make the necessary changes. Otherwise, is we just, you know, we get beat to death down at this, at the bottom level, because we don't have any tools to work with, because our resources, both in terms of financial and human resources. We teachers are drying up. I mean, what's happening in terms of our kids coming, being able to make it from the bottom quartile to go back in, send it, go back in the communities to work. That was beginning to become some political questions. How do you really begin to build or rebuild these places so they can become communities for the people that we're trying to work with? It's not in terms of what they're trying to do in some place. So actually, poor people are being moved out of the inner city. Mm-hmm. Petersburg, Virginia is a good example. They're tearing down the projects, and they're moving the people into trailer homes into an adjacent county that has a large majority of whites. So they sit this small little area into trailer homes. Mm-hmm. And New Orleans is, Katrina was really where the whole process began to develop, emerge. Was after Katrina, because Katrina gave this country an opportunity to experiment on rebuilding the city from the ground up, which is the first time that has happened since Reconstruction. So New Orleans is this. So there, they didn't allow the people back in. And so they began to put together this one-third type community base pieces, one-third middle class, one-third low income, and one-third business across the city. Gentrification begins to move in. And so then the poor people moved, were not allowed to come back in. Those were being stuck in one part of the city. And that's happening in other places, Charleston, South Carolina, Richmond, Virginia, you name it, Detroit, Michigan, whatever you have is, this process of getting moved is what happened to poor people. So now one of the things that's helping that piece out is, well, you got privatization, privatization of education, centralism. So this is what's happening and moving in this country. And so to stop that, you have to have a real movement at the top whereby you got people to, with influences, to be able to try to make that, those political changes. That's one way the Alliance, one thing I think the Alliance can begin to do is really make a lot of noise at that particular level is. Not in terms of isolation is, but saying we're uniting together around the country with this particular focus.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. So that's what I had prepared for questions. Was there anything else you wanted to say about your experiences with SIAP or the National Alliance or any other part of what you've discussed today?
No, I think that that's about it. Is I think that the what we're trying to do is really develop our own little army of people, you know, that mm-hmm. young people and other people, just as we did in the Civil Rights Movement days. And so those people, finding people committed to this work, because that's what it's going to take for a while, is people committed for this work, there's no money in it, you know, is that we're committed to the same sacrifice, the same fervor and that we had in the 60s. I mean, this is it's back on us again, and we need to really begin to figure out the United States. So the Alliance is giving us that opportunity to right. do this. But I think that the, you know, but I'm not sure that the people in the Alliance already seen it as that type of a struggle yet, you know, and I think there's a real confusion is in terms of it's not, well, let's put it this way, there's not clarity yet in terms of what we mean by bottom quartile, what do we mean by moving this needle is, and so I don't think there's clarity yet is in terms of what the real issues are. Mm-hmm. You know, are the issues really around what's in the classroom, you know, as what's being taught in the classroom? Or is it the issue around just who is it that these are being taught? I know this information is getting to. students is, or is it really moving the system as a whole? You know, and my position is like moving the system as a whole and not in isolation. And so when you talk about quality education, what does that mean is, and we need to begin to focus on that is, and making this as a national movement, you know, which has to involve and include people, you know, from what we call the low performing areas and low income areas of the bottom quartile. So what's happening in the country is about this, is there is a swoop. There's also a friend of mine talks about, it's almost like drilling for oil or whatever you have is, you know, but actually it's going after, you know, kids are able to make it up to the fourth grade. You got programs that's grabbing and helping to move them up. But when you're going to have to go deeper than that is, we're not doing anything that's going really deeper as a unit is. You get to these kids, you know, from birth on up is, because to do that is you got to change, you know, I mean, you got to get to kids, you know, at birth. You got to get to them at early ages. And that has to do with the places they live, how they live, you know, what resources are available to them is, so that they can become, you know, by the time kids get to be 5 and 6 years old, living in some of these areas, they already suffer from PTSD. You know, they already come in with different issues and problems that are unbelievable based upon the fact that it's a condition that they're forced to live in.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you begin to address this issue as a whole, as a national issue? So yeah, I don't think you can look at it in isolation, you know. You have to figure out how to bring all this together.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Dave, for taking the time to talk to me today.
Okay, thank you for calling.